Well, it's that time again for your fix of the far middle. Welcome and thanks for tuning in. This, of course, is Nick Deolius. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. Check out the nickdeolius.com website. I'm always adding new content to it. Hey, I am really excited for this episode of the far middle because it's number 29. And 29 is the number of one of my all-time favorites from my all-time favorite era of pro sports. And that, of course, is the 1970s. I'm sticking to baseball, and I'm dedicating this episode to the ultimate number 29, in my mind at least, the great Rod Carew. Now, Rod Carew, he was a great baseball player, and he was also and is also a stellar human being. He was born in Panama, and when he was born, it was during a time of racial segregation down in Panama. In fact, he was born on a train where his mom had to sit in the back or the rear cars of the train that was basically allocated to non-whites. Whites sat in the front cars. And while on this train ride, Rod, I guess, wouldn't wait to be born until the train ride was over. So he was delivered in that train car, and a fellow passenger who was a doctor helped deliver him for Mrs. Carew. And the name of the doctor was Dr. Rodney Klein. So Mrs. Carew was so thankful to the doctor after she delivered her baby boy that she named her baby Rodney Klein Carew. That's an amazing story. So Rod Carew got his first and middle name from the doctor that jumped into service and delivered him unexpectedly on a train ride in Panama. Now here's another amazing thing about Rod Carew. He never played baseball in high school, and he really didn't get focused on baseball until he was around 18 years old. So he moved to the States when he was a teenager, I think around 14 years old, and he moved initially to Washington Heights in Manhattan. He played semi-pro ball for a team in the Bronx, and he ended up signing with the Twins. And what I sort of love is the fact that you've got Rod Carew sort of signing a major league contract with the Twins when he's playing in the Bronx and living in Manhattan. And I just love the fact that the Yankees, literally with their stadium casting a shadow on Rod Carew in New York City, didn't know about him or sign him. And by the way, he signed at a dinner at the restaurant Stella de Oro, which was affiliated with the famous Bronx bakery that made those awesome cookies and treats that some of you might be familiar with. That's sort of a iconic Bronx establishment from the past where he actually signed his contract. Now, his career was, of course, epic. It spanned a long period of time, 67, when he came up through 1985. So that's a heck of a long career in terms of longevity. He played for two teams, effectively the Twins, right, and then the Angels. And when he signed with the Angels after his trade, he became for a while the highest paid player in baseball, and deservedly so from my perspective. The best term that I could use to describe his on-the-field ability would be hitting machine, because that's what he was. He led the league in hits and triples a number of different years. He was a batting average champion six times, and he could run really well. He was no stranger to stealing bases and running the base paths very efficiently and effectively. In fact, he set the record for stealing home in a season. He did it seven times in 1969. Billy Martin was the manager of the Twins at the time and really encouraged Carew to take on sort of that opportunity to steal home across the course of the season, doing the risk-reward math. He got really good at it and accomplished the feat seven times, which was a record. I think he was an all-star every year of his career except for the last year in 85. That's an amazing accomplishment and statistic. He was league MVP in 77, 3,000 hit club member, and of course a Hall of Famer. His lifetime batting average, 328. Wow. And, you know, some critics of Carew, and I guess there's a few out there, I don't know what they're thinking, but they always point to his lack of power. Don't talk to me about Rod Carew's lack of power. When you hit and run the bases like he did, you don't need to be hitting 40 home runs a year. He was more than efficient and effective as a player. Now, Carew was also a military veteran. He served 6 years in the Marine Corps Reserves as a combat engineer. As if we needed another reason to love the guy, could you imagine a pro athlete today, let alone one of the best and biggest stars today, serving for 6 years in the Marine Corps, whether it's the Reserves or active? Sort of unbelievable. And Rod Carew had some of the best baseball cards ever. I'm a big baseball card, football card aficionado, especially from that era of the 70s, of course. But Rod Carew's Topps 1977 card is one of my favorite all-time cards, my favorite one of his through his long run of baseball cards through the years. So here's to the great Rod Carew. I hope he's in good health and doing well. Now, when Carew was assessing whether he would try to steal home plate, and he got really good at assessing that, right? As I said, he was very successful at it. He was basically performing a risk-reward analysis. He was making informed decisions by objectively weighing the upsides and downsides with all the facts and circumstances for that particular situation. So let's jump from Carew and baseball to investing in markets, because success in both is going to, in the end, depend really on clear-headed clinical risk-reward assessment. And when one looks to the stock market today, and frankly, the economy in general, I think this applies to the economy as well as the stock market, these days you see growing risks and diminishing rewards. The Federal Reserve, and I'll just give you some examples and instances of why I believe that. I'm going to start with the Fed. The Federal Reserve has propped up the financial markets for years now. That's no secret. And it was tough to fight the Fed when it had trillions of dollars to deploy toward its balance sheet. But the Fed right now looks to be spent. It looks to be spent in balance sheet dollars. And I think more troubling, I fear, it looks to be spent in credibility. And Jerome Powell's new term notwithstanding, I don't think that's going to make much of a difference. In fact, it might make it worse, one would argue. What has been the biggest mover of the market in the up direction now might become the biggest mover of the market in the down direction. So what's that adage? What goes up must come down. And now that Fed tapering is beginning to start, I'd be wary. Things could get volatile, and the Fed could play a central role in that volatility. Now, in addition to the Fed, or maybe tied to the Fed, and one of the consequences of its policies is inflation. That's a new worry. It's a new and a big problem for markets, and it's creating risks that's associated with capital markets everywhere you look. Basically, the way I'd sum it up when it comes to inflation is that inflation kills. It kills wage growth and the earnings power of workers. It kills wealth and savings. We've seen both of those. It kills margins and profitability. We're going to start to see inflation rear its head with earnings warnings or earnings results, I believe, with a whole bunch of different industries when they start reporting and projecting expectations for, say, earnings for Q4 of 21 and then expectations for earnings of 2022. And it kills our future. At some point, equity valuations are going to wake up to these facts, and they're going to adjust accordingly. They always do. And what's maddening about the inflation specter is that, like the Fed and its monetary policy, this is another self-induced problem. Government policy, and a lot of it, of course, being pushed by the left, it manufactures, literally manufactures inflation and punishes the middle class and the working poor. It's only going to be a matter of time before what the workers know to be true and what they're experiencing now is going to be realized by Wall Street, and it's going to be reflected in stock prices. So I guess thanks, President Biden. Thanks, Build Back Better, or so-called Build Back Better. And thank you, administrative state and environmentalists. Great jobs by all of you. Oh, wait, is this inflation just transitory? That's what we've been told. I guess everything in life other than infinity is going to be transitory to some degree. It just depends on how creative and how flexible you want to be with your time horizon. And it's not just Fed policy and inflation we got to worry about when it comes to markets and valuations, but now we got to worry about supply chain. Our constricted supply chain is going to impact capital markets because it squeezes revenues and margins and profitability. If you can't get the stuff you need to make what you sell, or if you can't get your products to buyers, you've got a fundamental business problem. This is business economics 101. And we talked on a prior episode of The Far Middle about Long Beach, the Port of Long Beach, on a recent trip to California. And you take the issue with Long Beach and you multiply that and spread it out across our entire nation, you begin now to get a sense for what we're dealing with today. It's a massive issue. And like inflation and monetary policy, much if not all of it is self-induced by government policy created by the left and, of course, run by the bureaucratic state. And another headwind, just add to the wall of worry that is going to impact market valuations sooner or later, is what all economists and experts are calling now this the Great Resignation, this term that they reference, the Great Resignation. The expert class was caught completely off guard with this development, but you don't need a PhD from an Ivy League institution to see this coming. Government shut down economies across the board during the pandemic. Government entitlements paid people to stay at home. Government creates regulatory barriers to companies to hiring more workers. Government creates barriers to working for workers, like these silly vaccine mandates and all the drama and angst it drums up. And then what you see cumulatively is work ethic gets eroded, doers are penalized, ergo the Great Resignation. That is not going to help capital markets or valuation of different pieces of equities and debt markets. And while all these headwinds keep popping up, guess what? The market is still at an abnormally high price-to-earnings ratio. There's not enough discussion about that. I'm sort of surprised at how little discussion there is of this. The current PE for the S&P 500 is just under 30, and that is very high when you compare it to the historical norms and the historical standards. The mean over history for PE of the S&P is under 16, so we're almost twice the norm on average. And when the price-to-earnings ratio gets abnormally high due to exuberance, guess what? That's a sign for correction. Always has been, and it's probably going to end up being the case that it's going to be in this instance as well. I mean, when you look at this, how many reasons does an investor, whether it's a mom-and-pop saver or a gigantic hedge fund or mutual fund or index fund, how many reasons do you need to get worried about the state of our capital markets? I'm already there for sure. But now, you know, little disclaimer, the truth be told, I've been calling for a market correction for some time now because many of these sort of factors that I just ran through have been present and been playing a role for a significant period of time. But the market not only hangs in there, it just keeps going up. So it's not even just treading water. It keeps getting, you know, larger and larger in terms of the bubble being inflated. So, you know, what do I know? Well, I do know one thing for sure. Math and fundamentals are undefeated in this world. And sooner or later, these types of market euphorias that are lacking a sound, I'll call it ballast of fundamentals, they're ultimately going to self-correct. We don't know when, but we know they're going to. And let me use this topic of capital markets and sort of the wall of worry that is going to impact valuations, I believe, sooner, not later. And let me switch to one that's tied to that, because this discussion item that I'm going to talk about next is certainly going to move markets. It always has historically, and it certainly will do so in the future. And it's a massive wild card that I see now in front of us that no one is talking about, but that should be discussed constantly in every newspaper you pick up, every station that you listen to, every website that you click on. And that is the wild card of geopolitical risk. Right now, I see four massive risks on the geopolitical map that could send markets and, frankly, the world economies, world societies into a tumult. And the first one, the first of these four wild cards is what our friend Vladimir Putin is up to in Russia. So while he's laughing at the foolishness that is going on in Glasgow as the Western world commits economic suicide, right, by embracing this climate zealotry, what's he doing? He's busy with things not just beyond what I'll call using natural gas as a geopolitical weapon against his rivals in the EU. So he's been really good at that. While we're committing this economic suicide and sort of strategic suicide with this climate zealotry, he's using natural gas now as a very effective geopolitical weapon against the EU. But he's also doing some other things. And one thing in particular that he seems focused upon is how he can take back the Ukraine. Not eastern Ukraine, but all of the Ukraine. Over 100,000 troops are now amassed along Ukraine's borders, and that includes the border with Russia's ally and satellite Belarus. I fear, folks, that the Ukraine is in some serious trouble. And I have an even greater fear that the spineless and rudderless leaders in the EU, unfortunately in the United States, NATO, between the two, they're not going to do a thing to stop Putin if he crosses the line. And I've got the biggest fear being that Putin knows all of this, and that's factoring into his math and his risk-reward decision-making. Now, the second powder keg that I see developing is North Korea. Remember them? We forgot about the Hermit Kingdom. That's all we talked about for a long time. Every time they launched a missile or said something crazy, but then we just stopped listening and watching them. It's like they just sort of fell off the radar. Well, there's nothing like being ignored that's going to stoke up the dictator in Pyongyang to do something to get attention. He does not like being ignored. And don't think for a minute he's going to sit idle and behave. He senses that no one's paying attention, and he senses distractions, say the United States might have, with other hotspots in the world, and then he sees opportunity. So expect something. I think it'd be prudent to expect something on the nuclear weapon front or a missile launch soon from North Korea. And remember, what's really crazy to think about when it comes to the Korean Peninsula, Seoul, that thriving capital of South Korea, it sits just 35 miles away from the DMZ. So it doesn't take a lot of activity or action to completely wreak havoc and devastate a key part of the world. Now, the third hotspot is our old friend in Iran, the Iranian regime. And the Iranians, I think, they are seeing clearly a smorgasbord of opportunity with the Biden administration. So on one hand, you got climate czar Kerry. He is known to provide pallets of cash to the Islamic Republic in exchange for hollow promises. He's done it before. Iran knows that, and they know that they can have it both ways. So on one hand, they can sponsor terrorism, they can pursue nukes, they can roil oil markets in the supply chain, and on the other hand, they can do all that while still getting paid. So now that President Biden is hell-bent on surrendering U.S. energy independence, Iran realizes that the Persian Gulf is back to being important again. We made it important again. And Iran is going to use that to create leverage at our expense. It's almost a guarantee that they will do that. And then, as if those first three hotspots and wild cards weren't enough, we've got the fourth and final one. It worries me the most. I saved the worst one for last. And why does it worry me the most? Well, they're the most dangerous. They are the most astute. And I think, frankly, they take the longest term focus of all. And that, of course, is China, the Chinese Communist Party. Particularly the issues I'm most concerned about is what's going on with Taiwan and the South China Sea. I get the sense, and you should too, that it's just a matter of time before China moves on Taiwan. And why is that just a matter of time? Because they know that Washington isn't going to do anything. We're busy with political correctness. We're busy with solar panels on aircraft carriers. We're busy with vaccine mandates and all those games with vaccine mandates. That's what our military is all focused upon. And our climate czar is giving up God knows what geopolitical concessions to China in exchange for some hollow statement to work together on concrete actions to tackle climate change. I don't know if you saw that statement or not, but the Chinese-U.S. joint statement, which basically said nothing. It was celebrated as if, you know, it was sort of the Treaty of Versailles that was agreed to, but there were these terms of tackling climate change that you always see gets ridiculous, and then concrete actions. What I found to be ironic about the concrete actions statement from this joint Chinese-U.S. Press release or whatever it was that there's an awful lot of carbon that has to go into the making of concrete. Sort of ironic, isn't it? So, you know, the world is getting more dangerous, more volatile. It's getting more menacing by the day. Do you think our leaders in D.C. are on it? Do you have more or less faith in our commander-in-chief, our climate czar, the Pentagon brass, and our State Department than you did a few years ago? Our adversaries, they're not dumb. They are not going to remain static. They watch, they plan, they move, they do astute risk-reward assessment. And by the way, they coordinate. So whether it's Iran and Russia and North Korea and China, they're not acting independently. They understand how their interests can be aligned. And I think that you could be seeing situations now where everything that's going on with Belarus, with this immigration issue, with Poland, Russia amassing troops along the border of the Ukraine, what North Korea may or may not do, Iran with their saber rattling or an incident here or there in the Persian Gulf, I think a lot of that is being coordinated to distract, to bleed away attention and resources of the United States from China so that China is given an opportunity to act sooner rather than later on some of its strategic ambitions. Now, while Russia and China and Iran and North Korea are manipulating and prepping, what do we do? What are we doing? We focus on tackling climate change. That's what we're doing in D.C. That's what they were doing in Glasgow. That's what they're doing in New York at the United Nations. But when I said we, I really misspoke, because we know that climate change is not anywhere near the top of the worry chart. I should have instead said our elite. And why do I know that we know that it's not that big of an issue when it comes to climate change relative to other concerns or issues that are out there? Well, Gallup did a poll, and this poll was of 2020 registered U.S. voters. and they asked the importance of various issues. So they asked these registered voters to rank these different issues of importance. And guess what? Climate change came in at number 15. What was number one? The economy, not a shocker. National security was second. Education, healthcare, crime, pandemic, and race relations followed just after those. And then you had foreign affairs. China came in at number 12, probably too low for my liking, but it was still ahead of climate change. And Russia was number 16 just after climate, which again was at number 15. Now, if normal Americans place climate change at the bottom of the wall of worry, why are our leaders so obsessed about it? Because the elites don't care what we think any more than they care about the reality and the science and the risks and the threats. Climate change policy has proven to be a form of religion. It's an ideology. It's in essence a belief system. And it's going to be pushed and forced no matter what the reality and what the science is. So when elites want to magically pursue tackling climate change and all the power and authority and control that comes with that, they ignore the polls of those they work for and were elected by, and then they go to work changing the polls by indoctrination. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And what's sad about this, and maybe I should say instead what's most sad about this, because there's a lot that's sad about this, is that by pursuing the tackling of climate change, it means that we make many of those legitimate fears of voters worse. We're making all these other things actually worse that are legitimate things to be concerned about or focused upon. So what do I mean by that? Well, climate change policy, it's a killer to our economy. We're seeing that as we speak. It's playing out literally real time. And again, economy is the number one issue, rightfully so, of voters. It erodes national security because energy security equals national security. And when you go and give up energy independence in the form of domestic oil and natural gas production, and you replace it with a dependency on China for wind and solar ingredients and components, you lose. And that was the second top issue when it came to that poll of registered voters. It hurts jobs in the middle class, climate change policy, which means less people are going to be able to provide for their families. And what does that lead to? Well, that leads to less education, that leads to worsening healthcare, that leads to higher crime. And those are all concerns or issues, specifically numbers 3, 4, and 5 on that Gallup poll that I just referenced. And then all that tackling of climate change, you know what? It's really expensive stuff. And that makes our taxes higher. That's issue number 14. And it makes our federal budget deficit bigger, which was issue number 11 on the list of the Gallup poll. And chasing climate ideology in the form of these, you know, silly, hollow photo ops and statements with entities like China that I just referenced, it also leads to an emboldened China or Iran or Russia. They see opportunity, they see weakness with this ridiculous policy that we pursue. And guess what? Those are also issues on that list of as well. So climate change, look, it's not a top 10 issue for voters. It should not be a top 20 concern for voters. And elites making the top issue inevitably is going to make these other more legitimate issues more challenging, in worse shape, more troublesome, and is going to do so quick. Now, if you think that this obsession of our elites on tackling climate change pales in comparison to other more legitimate issues, or does not, worse yet, make all of these other legitimate issues put us in an even deeper hole and worse situations with regard to those other issues, I want to do something here that's just an interesting, I think, exercise, which is to take a stroll through the current news. So I performed an exercise here right before the taping of this podcast. I went through yesterday's newspapers and an online news aggregator. I spent 15 minutes before the recording to see what I could find that was specific examples, evidence, call it, of other issues being far more important and far more pressing than tackling climate change. And also looking for instances where the obsession of tackling climate change has made these other issues worse. Because of the elite insisting that we tackle climate change and make it a top priority, which inevitably has a consequence of either reduced attention on very meaningful, legitimate issues or, you know, counterproductive to those issues themselves. Now, again, all of these developments that I'm going to run through, they coincide with the elites and our elected officials placing climate change and the zealotry that goes with it at the top of the priority list. So, you know, forgive me for shuffling through some papers here, but I just want to run through some of these that I found in that little quick 15-minute sort of tour. First, I'm going to start with drug overdose deaths. You guys may have seen this. We hit a record in the United States for a 12-month period, 100,000 drug overdose fatalities. That's a record for this country. A lot of it, of course, driven by fentanyl. Where is the feedstocks for fentanyl coming from? Of course, it's coming from China. So here you have health, which was one of those major issues of that Gallup poll, rightfully so, and a health issue here, a health crisis that's created with drug overdose and drug overdose fatality epidemic. China plays a role front and center there. But because we're focused and obsessed about tackling climate change and those concrete actions, we've got our climate czar, Kerry, who's more interested in that hollow press release and joint statement than he is holding China accountable for literally killing tens of thousands of Americans through drug overdoses. Another sort of article I just came across, Europe, which is sort of in many ways a harbinger because of their insanity when it comes to climate change policy zealotry being a little bit ahead of us. That's sort of where we're heading. If you want to see our future, take a look to the EU. But in Europe, power price inflation, so the price for power, for electricity, is way up. Inflation is running rampant when it comes to power prices. And one of the side effects is that coal power plants, so coal-fired power plants, have become very profitable in Europe. So you got EU policy and this climate change policy that is supposed to be eradicating coal on the continent, along with all fossil fuels. But the policies drive up the price of natural gas. Natural gas is one of the bedrock foundations of the power grid, perhaps the bedrock foundation of Europe's power grid, just like it is in the United States. So natural gas becomes more expensive. It doesn't become as readily available. In some instances, you can't even get the supply of natural gas, let alone what you would pay for it. Thus, coal plants have to fill the void. They're the only things that are left because wind and solar are not reliable if the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. And then all of a sudden, the price for power from coal plants goes way up, and the profitability of these coal-fired power plants goes way up. Completely counter, 180-degree opposite of what these elite bureaucrats and the elite politicians in Europe were trying to do with their tackling of climate change. And I found it interesting in this article, there was a trader, a carbon platform trader, that was asked, well, how can this be? Like, why are these coal-fired power plants so profitable when everything that you've rigged, everything that you've manufactured and created with all of your expert class was designed to do the exact opposite, to make them obsolete? And her response was, quote, we're in a special situation, end quote. Yeah, that's for sure. That special situation she's referencing is called reality. That's a common situation that our elite class oftentimes struggles with. I saw another interesting article of all things dealing with the continent of Africa. Now, Africa right now has about 1.3 billion people on the continent, but that population is expected to double in a short period of time by 2050. So between now and 2050, the population of Africa is going to go from 1.3 billion to 2.6 billion people. And a lot of those individuals, unfortunately, do not enjoy a high quality of life. And a big reason, or perhaps the biggest reason for that, is that they don't have access to reliable and affordable electricity. So we don't have access to electricity, healthcare, education, life expectancy, infant mortality, all those things take a hit. Now, what this individual was making the point of, and this is the president of Uganda, so this is a leader of a major African nation, was that all of this climate change zealotry and policy that goes with it, it's forcing wind and solar projects across Africa. And that is increasing the costs, delaying the time to access to affordable and reliable electricity. And it's basically extending the period of time where a significant portion of those 1.3, soon to be 2.6 billion people on the continent are still going to have to live very hard and desolate lives because they don't have that access to reliable and affordable electricity via things like natural gas. Again, another. And that, by the way, leads to what's one of those issues on that Gallup poll? One of those issues ahead of climate was immigration. Because when people from all different corners of the globe run into very harsh living conditions or all kinds of crises that are hitting them, what do they do? They look to go to better places. They become desperate. And that leads to a lot of the immigration concern and angst that you see, not just in the United States, but the world over. Department of Defense. This one really, really worries me. It seems like our Department of Defense is no longer significantly or primarily focused about winning the next war, but instead it's worried, the leadership of the Department of Defense is worried about climate change and tackling climate change. I've got a quote here from Secretary Lloyd Austin, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, right, the number one guy. He said that there are a few threats to national security that deserve to be called existential, but that climate change qualified. That is our defense secretary. So he's calling climate change an existential threat to national security. And thus, of course, right, the Pentagon is going to prioritize climate change considerations. So going back to concerns like national security on that list that we spoke about from Gallup, China, Russia, I'm not sure that the Defense Department are making those legitimate concerns any better. I have a feeling they're making them worse. You go from Defense Department in Africa and coal-fired power plants in the EU, let's go to New York City, Rikers Island, one of the largest correctional facilities in the nation. It's in crisis. And why is it in crisis? You've got scores of inmates in the facility that are left unguarded. You've got suicide attempts with the prisoners that are skyrocketing. You've got the correctional officer staff, which are in the thousands. In New York City, a third of correctional officers at Rikers are out sick or can't work with prisoners. A third of your workforce is basically placed on the sidelines for a whole host of reasons. It's frankly, at Rikers, a humanitarian crisis for the prisoners, for the correctional staff, and ultimately for the citizenry when those individuals are released or not basically taken off the streets when committing crimes because of the crisis that you've got at a facility like Rikers. Now, while all that's going on at Rikers, the soon-to-be ex-mayor of New York, right, de Blasio, is more worried about, again, tackling climate change. He's worried about changing light bulbs in New York's government buildings or New York City's housing institutions and public housing sites. And he's more worried about banning things like propane space heaters for outdoor eating establishments. That's where his focus and his attention is. That's the current crisis, tackling climate change. And you've got this humanitarian crisis that's going on at the largest correctional facility, or one of the largest correctional facilities in the land, Rikers Island. It's a travesty. And then another, right, sort of front and center leader when it comes to tackling climate change is the state of California, the cities of San Francisco, Los Angeles. Well, what's going on out there while they are busy, you know, doing things like banning lawnmowers and leaf blowers that are not electric because of climate change? Well, now you've got this coordinated mass looting that's occurring in all these luxury malls and luxury shops, from Rodeo Drive to these high-end malls to downtown San Francisco and Union Square and everywhere in between. So it doesn't matter if it's a drugstore, if it's a Nordstrom's, a Louis Vuitton. You see this happening now where there's dozens and dozens of these individuals that are just showing up out of nowhere, sometimes in the evening, middle of the day, doesn't matter. And they're basically clearing out and cleaning out these retail establishments with their merchandise. And now you got this leadership in California, in the cities and in the state, trying to figure out how to stop it. I saw that they're going to put the highway patrol officers on the on-ramps and off-ramps to the interstates to try to stop the looters from escaping with the merchandise. And unfortunately, I just feel this in my bones. I think it's obvious. It's just a matter of time before someone is going to be killed or seriously injured in one of these events. So when you can't safely walk in a mall or to a store in a major American city or in one of our largest states, that is a big problem when it comes to quality of life and a whole host of issues listed on that Gallup poll. And again, the distraction of all that's going on, we're worried or they're worried about how they're going to tackle climate change and ban the gas-powered lawnmower or the gas-powered leaf blower. Our Department of Health and Human Services, okay, so healthcare being one of those big issues, rightfully so, at the top of voters' minds. Well, now the Department of Health and Human Services, I found out, is creating the Office of Climate Change and Health Equity. So, you know, COVID, I guess, isn't enough to worry about. This opioid epidemic and 100,000 drug overdose deaths, that's not enough to be worried about. Our situation with the VA and the VA hospitals, that's not enough to be worried about. Obesity, social media and the impact on teenagers, youth crime, and what that does to the health of our nation's youth. I guess those things are not big enough problems. Instead, we're going to have HHS develop this Office of Climate Change and Health Equity. And this is the health issue that's requiring more resources that we need to create a new office for within HHS. They don't have enough to focus upon and worry about. I thought you'd find one of these quotes. They asked the health secretary how he would reduce carbon emissions from healthcare facilities. And his response was, "We will use every authority to its greatest advantage because it is time to tackle climate change now." That's your head of health and human services. So I could sort of go on and on, but the last thing I'll leave it with, I didn't find this one in my 15-minute exercise, but it's one that I know pretty well because we talked about it extensively in prior episodes of The Far Middle. Education of our public schools, and particularly our urban public school districts, education proficiency of kids in those districts is very embarrassing. It's just an affront to a civil society. And why and what's going on? Well, the system is teaching and indoctrinating climate ideology with these kids instead of teaching them math, instead of improving science proficiency, instead of improving English proficiency. And it shows with the abysmal proficiency rates across those three metrics across a whole host of our biggest school districts in the land. Well, that just about wraps up episode 29 of the Far Middle podcast. And I hope you enjoyed the connection of dots for this episode. We started with number 29, the great Rod Carew, how he was great at risk-reward math of things like stealing home plate. We then got into the risk-reward of capital markets and how there's an increasing wall of worry when you do the clinical assessment. This should get you concerned about valuations. We then went into one of the biggest in that wall of worry when it comes to capital market valuations being geopolitics. And there's four wild cards of North Korea and Iran and Russia and, of course, China. And then we talked about how real Americans get the real issues and the real risks right, placing climate change far down the list. But our elites seem to be obsessed about tackling climate change and how that has all kinds of consequences and collateral damage. It's being done to those more legitimate issues in front of it. And we walk through a whole bunch of current real world examples, just spending literally 15 minutes going through the news. Next episode, I'm going to summarize something I'm really excited about, which is a speech that I'll be giving at a major energy conference here in Pittsburgh. And I think there's some important sort of policy views and issues to point out with respect to the speech. And I want to cover those in the upcoming episode of The Far Middle, which will be episode number 30. Until then, enjoy your week, and I'll be back to you soon enough.